Tonight's local program's presentation comes from an Alturas Institute event, Constitutional Conversations with Dr. David Gray Adler, recorded July 25th. At the Willards Arts Center in Idaho Falls, the topic, the Supreme Court and Equal Protection of the Law, Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity. Due to a technical difficulty, portions of this program have been removed from our broadcast. More information at alturasinstitute.com. You can also learn more about tonight's lecturer there. Here's Dr. David Gray Adler.
Constitutional Conversations. Very happy that you could join us here tonight at the Carr Gallery here in Idaho Falls for the first of two discussions dealing with the Constitution and the rights of the LGBT community. Certainly an issue of great importance across America these days, and the driver of a number of cases working their way up through the judicial pipeline, no doubt headed to the Supreme Court of the United States. I want to thank our sponsors tonight, Jerry and Carrie Scheid, thanks so much, and also Breaking Boundaries for their support. Thank you so much. One of the mission statements of the Alturas Institute is, of course, to promote equal protection of the law, as well as civic education and gender equality. And tonight's subject gives us an excellent opportunity to do just that, to talk about a subject that we've not dealt with very often, but which certainly rounds out our pursuit of discussions involving equal protection of the law. When we talk about the law and the gay and lesbian community, we're talking about a community which has faced considerable discrimination across America ever since the founding, meaning it's not been unlike the discrimination that has visited women and also the discrimination that has visited racism. So we might say all three groups from the founding period have been dealt their fate from the bottom of the deck. Of course, you know that ancient regimes believed that homosexual behavior, as it was so often described, was aberrant, crimes against nature. Laws did not protect gays and lesbians across the world. And here in America, it was not any different. Here in the United States, the discrimination against members of the LGBT community was so rampant that members were, of course, forced to hide. And so for so many years, the question was not how many members of the LGBT community exist in America, certainly millions and millions, but how many would dare to come out publicly. The reality is that life began to change here in America in June of 1969, 50 years ago this summer, when the Stonewall riots occurred in New York City, in the Southern Village in Greenwich, New York, at a bar which was known as a gay bar. And the difference between the Stonewall Inn and so many other gay bars in that part of New York City was this was one of the very few that permitted dancing. It was a rarity that members of the community could engage in dancing precisely because if you were seen engaging in any same-sex behavior, kissing, holding hands, or more, you would be arrested. And it wouldn't be the case that you would merely be arrested, you would be beaten before you were put in the paddy wagon and taken to jail. It was brutal treatment of gays and lesbians. So this was a bar that was purchased by members of the mafia. Three members paid about $3,500 apiece in the spring of 1969 to take over this bar. It wasn't much. There was no running water behind the bar, which meant that when glasses were used, they were simply dipped through a tub of water, and that qualified as cleaning them. The toilets ran over. The rooms were painted black, and the reason why people felt some security in dancing was because of the system that worked out. The system involved corrupt police who would tip off the bartenders and say there's going to be a raid tonight. And the corruption was so thorough that the raids were timed early in the evening so that the police would come through, they would leave, and then the dancing and the drinking and the partying could ensue. So nobody's night was terribly ruined. And of course, this worked because the owners of the bar paid off the police officers. So not a happy chapter when it comes to law and order in America. But one night, somebody failed to tip off the bar owners that a raid was coming. And when police officers arrived, not the usual crew, they didn't know how the game worked, and they actually came in and they started making arrests. As they dragged out some people who had been partying at the Stonewall Inn, they began to engage in very physical treatment, beating a few people, dragging a few people, throwing a few people on the ground, and that caused a scene because people at neighborhood bars saw that violence was occurring, and those who were in fact arrested became violent as well. So it broke out into a riot, and before you knew it, hundreds of people were there on the sidewalk, spilling into the streets, and so the police department called in many, many more police officers. That served to swell the crowd. Before night's end, hundreds were arrested, many taken to the hospital. And that marked what we call the Stonewall Riots, which persisted then for several days because others would come back there and continue their protests. Newspapers, including New York Times, the New York Daily News, the New York Post, covered this 24/7, so to speak, and they used various names, the Stonewall Protest, the Stonewall Rebellion, the Stonewall Riots. The reality was, at that point in time, life for members of the LGBT community began to take a turn because through well-funded efforts, local newspapers to promote the interests and the rights of the community were established. And so from that point forward now, there were news sources publishing stories in which the rights and the interests and the values of the LGBT community became page one news. It didn't take very long, moreover, before the first gay pride marches or parades were held. The first one was 1 year later in New York City on that same date, and then also in Los Angeles and Chicago and Boston and San Francisco. And this unleashed the LGBT movement, not unlike the women's rights movement or the civil rights movement before it. The movement, as it was called, took its instruction from the success enjoyed by both the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement. It was good at attracting publicity, stating its case for its rights and privileges, and garnering, as I say, tremendous media attention. At that point, many lawyers who were members of the gay community decided that they would start defending members who were arrested. And this is one of the very first times this happened. Some of the lawyers who took up the cause were law faculty at surrounding universities, New York University, for example, and others, and they became very much involved in defending their clients, just as members of the ACLU legal team defended members of the African American community and took up the cudgels on behalf of the women's movement. So there was a model in place and they followed it. In the next several years, as it was said, by 1974 or so, legal scholars were beginning to make the case that the rights enjoyed by women and African American members of the United States should also be granted to members of the LGBT community. And their arguments rested on a couple of fundamental claims about the Constitution, which I want to spend some time talking about.
We will return in one moment with more Constitutional Conversations with Dr. David Gray Adler on KISU-FM.
KISU works hard to ensure the reliability of our FM signal, but occasionally, seasonal weather or equipment failures cause us to go off the air. Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org, or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Hi, I'm Jackie Biergen, Academic Advisor for the Pre-Health Professions at Idaho State University. We're proud to be Idaho's designated health professions university. Healthcare providers of the future are learning alongside experienced professionals with the innovative, hands-on education tools they need to prepare them for their chosen field. Our students' success is evident in looking at their promising percentages from the 2017-2018 school year, when over 65% of ISU students who applied for medical school were accepted, many with multiple offers. This compares to just 38% for all of Idaho and 41% nationwide. Idaho State, your hometown university.
We now rejoin Constitutional Conversations with Dr. David Gray Adler. In part one of a two-part series, you can join Constitutional Conversations this Thursday evening, August 8th at 7 p.m. at the Willards Arts Center, 480 A Street in Idaho Falls.
You could say that the fight for women's rights, well known as a fight for women's suffrage, which began in the mid-19th century, was accompanied by the assertion of a right to contraceptives. And it was a very fundamental part of the women's movement, because without access to contraceptives, women were, of course, becoming pregnant many, many times throughout their lives. As records indicated, women died at a young age, many were sick, there was no hope of getting an education, nobody was working outside the home, so it was very much limiting the opportunities for women. And so for nearly 80 years or so, women, particularly in the Northeast, through a number of organizations and sometimes on their own, had lobbied state legislatures, had lobbied people in Congress, arguing for a right to access contraceptives. The successful case, Griswold versus Connecticut, occurred in 1965, as I say, and there, for the first time in American history, the Supreme Court introduced a right to privacy. And this was an opinion written by Justice William O. Douglas of Yakima, Washington, who introduced a new theory of constitutional rights, in which he argued that in addition to enumerated rights in the Constitution, such as those that you could spy in the First Amendment, such as free speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion, due process, and so forth, there are also implied rights, which he called penumbral rights. Penumbral rights. These are rights, he said, which stand in the shadows of enumerated rights. And one of those rights, one of those penumbral rights, is the right to privacy. And he sketched out the theory as follows. He said, if in fact we honor the right to free speech, as set forth in the First Amendment, that must include the right to think our thoughts. We have within our minds then a zone of privacy that the state cannot enter. It is off limits to the government. Further, for those inclined to think about their relationship with the universe or with God, certainly there has to be protection in the name of privacy for persons to think about their relationship with God and the universe. And he went down the list, finding within the various provisions of the Bill of Rights various arguments for privacy. Certainly the Fourth Amendment was one, since we have protection against unreasonable search and seizure of our person, our papers, our belongings in our homes, then we could argue that we have a right to privacy in our homes. Now, Douglas was not maintaining that there was an absolute right to privacy, because that would be a foreign concept to the Constitution. all rights are limited. And then he also invoked the Ninth Amendment, which would become the subject of great controversy. The Ninth Amendment, which James Madison introduced as a kind of catch-all to protect against the possibility, when he introduced the Bill of Rights on June 9, 1789 in the first Congress, to protect against the possibility that he might overlook or fail to mention one of the rights. He did not want the nation to believe that the only rights they had were the only rights that citizens enjoyed were those enumerated in the Bill of Rights, because what would happen if we forgot one? And so the Ninth Amendment reads, quote, "The enumeration in this Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage other rights retained by the people." And one of those rights, he said, was the right to privacy. And he explained that in what he described as the sacred precincts of the marital bedroom, the state is not permitted to surveil or to examine what goes on within that bedroom. That is a right to privacy. And so thus the decision to use contraceptives would be a decision made within the sacred precincts of the marital bedroom, and thus the right to privacy was born out of this case. And it came at a very interesting time, because in 1965, at the height of the sexual revolution in America, it was interesting that the court extended this right to privacy only to married couples. Unmarried couples across the country had no right to access contraceptives, so there might have been some illegal actions or two from coast to coast. I'm just guessing, going down on a limb here. A couple of years later, the court did extend that Ninth Amendment right to unmarried couples as well. Griswold versus Connecticut then becomes a cornerstone in American jurisprudence for what follows, because there the court held that indeed there's a right to privacy to determine the use of contraceptive devices, which the court began to refer to as something approaching a right to an intimate lifestyle, an intimate lifestyle. And this became pretty common in scholarly literature in the late 60s and early 70s. If you hold that thought in your head for a second, a right of privacy which confers upon all citizens an intimate lifestyle, then you begin to understand why in Roe versus Wade in 1973, the controversial abortion decision, in which the court for the first time held that women, at least in the first trimester, enjoy a, quote, fundamental right to an abortion. And in the next two trimesters, then the state has growing authority to regulate the pregnancy. In that first trimester, the court could say there was a right to privacy as found in the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause, which conferred, again, an intimate lifestyle. What does the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause say? It says, the language reads, "No state shall make or enforce any law depriving any person of the rights to life, liberty, or property without due process of law." And Justice Blackmun, who wrote the opinion for the court, found within the liberty provision the right of a woman to express autonomy, to protect her autonomy over her reproductive organs. So here was then an early period, beginning with Griswold on up to Roe versus Wade, in which the court is identifying a right to an intimate lifestyle, which would include for women the determination of whether to use contraceptive devices and then whether or not to continue a pregnancy. Those two decisions then were very important for women's rights. They become very important as well for the assertion of rights for the gay and lesbian community, because now scholars in various law review articles at scholarly conferences and so forth could begin to argue that just as African Americans were the beneficiaries of the interpretation of the Constitution for purposes of expanding 14th Amendment protection under the Due Process Clause and for women as well, now the scholars could begin to argue if in fact, there is a right to privacy, there is also a duty on the part of the state to acknowledge that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment should also be applied to members of the LGBT community. So if women enjoyed as a matter of an intimate lifestyle the right to decide whether or not to use contraceptives, that should be broadened, it was argued, to include for gays and lesbians the right to engage in certain activities in their bedrooms. And the argument was then made that the Equal Protection Clause should mean equal protection for all people. Thus, the country was then primed for a series of cases which involved sodomy laws in various states, and this is where modern jurisprudence begins involving the gay and lesbian community. The first case that we want to turn to then is a 1986 case called Bowers versus Hardwick, a case arising out of Georgia. There was a Georgia statute that prohibited sodomy, which was an act defined as a relationship involving the sexual organs of one person and the mouth or anus of another person. So this was a very defined statute. And so it applied not merely to homosexuals, but also to heterosexuals. And the statute was passed by the Georgia legislature, exercising its broad police power to pass laws to promote the health, morals, welfare, and safety of its citizens, as perceived by Georgia legislators. In 1985, a man named Hardwick was entertaining a friend in his bedroom. He was a gay man, and a police officer had followed Hardwick home from a local bar and was following him, suspecting that he was probably gay after observing his behavior in that bar. When he reached the home, he saw that the front door was slightly ajar. So the police officer interpreted that as an invitation for him to enter the home. He entered the home, went into saw a man lying on the couch and said, "Is Hardwick here?" And the man on the couch said, "Yes, he's in the bedroom." The police officer proceeded there, opened the closed door, and saw Michael Hardwick and a friend engaging in sodomy. So the police officer arrested him. And before the case could get very far, the district attorney dismissed the case. It was going to be an obvious Fourth Amendment violation, and the district attorney was not interested in bringing charges of this sort. But Michael Hardwick decided he wanted to sue because he believed his right to privacy was violated. So after the federal district court dismissed the case, as I say, he appealed to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, known pretty widely as a fairly conservative circuit, as circuits go. And the circuit court upheld his claim of a right to privacy to engage in acts of sodomy. So that surprising decision, that set up the appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1986. Here in a split decision, a 1986 5-4 decision, Justice Byron White, who had been nominated to the court by John F. Kennedy, wrote the opinion upholding the statute and denied in the opinion that there is anything resembling a fundamental right for homosexuals to engage in acts of sodomy. As he put it, the question before the court is this: Does the Constitution confer upon Michael Hardwick a fundamental right to engage in acts of sodomy? And he said, we begin our discussion by asking, What do we mean by a fundamental right? And he turned back to a 1938 decision which introduced the concept of ordered liberty to determine what amounts to a fundamental right. And what is a fundamental right under the concept of ordered liberty? It would mean the denial of a right or the withdrawal of a right without which justice would not be possible in America. So that's what a fundamental right is. It has to be so important that if you deny the exercise of that right, then we're denied justice, and so therefore that activity should be declared a fundamental right. In addition to that, he said another way to ascertain whether there is a constitutional right to engage in acts of sodomy by virtue of the right to privacy is to ask, is this activity so deeply rooted in the practices and traditions and laws of our country so as to say, of course, it deserves protection? What did Justice White say on both grounds? He rejected both as a possibility for finding conferral of a constitutional right to engage in sodomy. On the first point about ordered liberty, he said it would be hard to believe that anybody could say, I'm paraphrasing, hard to believe that anybody could say with a straight face that the denial to homosexual men of a right to engage in homosexual activity would bring an end to justice in America. And the second part, which was probably a little stronger for him without having to engage in any ideological belief, was he asked, is there any foundation in our long history supporting homosexual activity? And there, of course, he was on solid ground to say no. The laws had always prohibited. Punishment had been visited upon the person engaged in the activity. So he couldn't find any fundamental right. Without a fundamental right, he was then able to say that there is, moreover, no resemblance to the right to privacy that we've seen set forth by the court in both Griswold versus Connecticut and Roe versus Wade. That is a right to privacy somehow grounded in familial activity or decisions about an intimate relationship. So he writes the opinion, striking it down. Remember, I said this was a 5-4 opinion. Justice Lewis Powell, who had been appointed by Richard Nixon, was nearing the very end of his career on the Supreme Court. In fact, he would retire at the end of this term. This was his last opinion. He wrote a concurring opinion. He joined the majority, and this was his concurring opinion, that he would be willing to strike down the statute if, in fact, Hardwick had been found guilty and punished because the punishment included up to 20 years in federal prison for an act of sodomy. But because there was no imprisonment, because the state essentially dropped the charges, it meant that he could find his way to join the majority. I mention this because not too long after this opinion was filed, the term of the court came to an end, and he retired. He mentioned at a little reception in his honor, in talking about this case with a couple of his law clerks, he observed, you know, I don't think I've ever met a homosexual man. And he was saying this to a clerk who was, in fact, gay. The point was, Justice Powell, like almost anybody else, could never know if they're talking to a gay man or a gay or a lesbian. And in fact, Justice Powell had previously said that. In conference, while the justices were discussing this case, Justice Powell told the fellow justices, well, I don't think I've ever met a gay man. Harry Blackmun, Justice Blackmun, who thankfully kept very detailed notes on what was said in the conference, wrote that he felt like telling Justice Powell at that very point, well, yes, you have. You've had at least 3 or 4 clerks that were gay, and I ought to tell you this. So that meant that Powell then was unsure about what he was discussing in his opinion, and then he went on to say, a couple of months later, he said if he had to do it all over again, he would have joined the other side. He would have voted to strike down the statute, but for the great lobbying effort, the intense pressure that had been put upon him by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Warren Burger. Burger groused about the case from the beginning. He wrote a concurring opinion. He was not particularly sympathetic to gays and lesbians, or particularly the claim that there was some sort of right to privacy here. So this little commentary opens a window onto the Supreme Court's discussions. As in other cases, it reminds us that that there are those cases in which there can be a fairly high degree of lobbying or an attempt to bring pressure on one's fellow justices. Certainly that goes back to the famous case of Brown versus the Board of Education, the desegregation decision, and in this one as well. This is 1986. Justice Powell then leaves the court, and the nomination to replace him is Robert Bork the very next summer. Robert Bork, of course, will end up being defeated. One of the things that Bork had told the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings was that he, in fact, was opposed to the constitutional principle of a right to privacy. So he was defeated, and what makes this ironic is that once Bork was defeated, then President Reagan nominated a man named Anthony Kennedy, Justice Kennedy, who goes on then to write several decisions upholding rights for the LGBT community. So stop and think about this for just a second. Look at how history might have been very, very different. If, in fact, Robert Bork had been confirmed, he who denied the existence of a right to privacy, and particularly a right to privacy that could undergird the assertion of gay rights, think how different history might have been. Often Americans ask that question in more contemporary setting by asking, what if Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had held hearings for Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee? He didn't, of course, and so then we got Justice Gorsuch, and two very different views. These what-if questions are always good questions to ask about potential nominees, rejected nominees, who comes next. So history could have been very different. It was very different precisely because Justice Kennedy's legacy is largely one of writing opinions upholding the constitutional rights of the LGBT community. So after the Hardwick decision in 1986, and the controversy surrounding it, which left intact the roughly 30 state laws across the country prohibiting sodomy. The law reviews are filled with articles criticizing the court. The movement, the LGBT movement, is heating up. It's expanding from coast to coast. And then the very next important case that we have is, in fact, Lawrence versus Texas in 2003. And this is the case in which Justice Kennedy writes the majority opinion that overturns Bowers versus Hardwick. Without going into the details of this case, which I'm sure would fascinate you, here simply is a state law in Texas that prohibits all sodomy. And so, let me rephrase that. I made an error. The Georgia statute prohibited all acts of sodomy. In Texas, the statute prohibits only homosexual acts of sodomy, just acts of sodomy engaged in by the LGBT community. So the fact pattern is remarkably similar to what I described in Bowers versus Hardwick, a police officer following home a man whom he believes is gay, entering the home without permission, as I say, very similar facts. When the case reaches the Supreme Court, this is the opportunity for Justice Kennedy now to begin to give life to the 14th Amendment liberty provision of the Due Process Clause, which he believes is broad enough to protect the right of individuals to make the most fundamental choices about how they're going to lead their lives, what decisions they're going to be making about the intimate nature of their lives, thus bringing it back to Griswold versus Connecticut and Roe versus Wade, citing those cases, anchoring the right to privacy and the broad right of autonomy to make the most important choices, saying, in effect, that when people make these choices about a married partner or a partner or sexual relations, they're making decisions that define them, that reflect their own moral personality, and that allow them to decide how they're going to lead their lives. If the state can tell individuals, you cannot be with this person or that person, you cannot engage in this activity in your bedroom, but this one, then let's draw up a list of the permissible activities as opposed to the impermissible activities, and how are these going to be enforced, and who's going to do the enforcing? So, at any rate, you see the problem. And so Justice Kennedy's opinion striking down the statute that prohibits homosexual sodomy is grounded in the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause, exalting liberty as a means of an expansive right to allow people to make choices governing the intimate parts of their lives. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor writes a concurring opinion, which means she agrees with the result, but for a different reason, and she invokes the Equal Protection Clause, making efficient work of the whole business. And she said, if Texas is going to prohibit homosexual sodomy, then it has to prohibit heterosexual sodomy, because, as she writes, it involves pretty much the same act. And so she didn't elaborate. So the statute is declared unconstitutional, and Kennedy is now building a name for himself in this regard, because if we wanted to engage in even more detail, I would have reviewed a 1996 Supreme Court decision out of Colorado, Romer versus Evans, which has pertinence for our subject next week, so I want to delay it, but let me just mention it briefly. There, the state of Colorado had passed a constitutional amendment called Amendment 2. This was passed in 1992, in which it prohibited all municipalities within the state from passing any laws to provide protection for gays and lesbians, what we today call, in one way or another, public accommodations. Municipalities had passed anti-discrimination ordinances saying you can't discriminate against people in education, in the workplace, or in the public, at restaurants, theaters, and so forth. Amendment 2 essentially wiped out all of those protections against discrimination and went one step further and said that the municipalities are forbidden from passing similar laws or ordinances in the future. So it was a sweeping denial of any kind of protection for gays and lesbians. The U.S. Supreme Court in Romer versus Evans in a 6-3 decision, again in an opinion written by Justice Kennedy, declares Amendment 2 unconstitutional as a violation of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause. That has pertinence for our discussion next week as we begin to talk about public accommodations laws. Anyway, you can see Kennedy then is making a name for himself. What's interesting about this is that, and this is just as an aside, for most of her career on the Supreme Court, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman appointed to the court by Ronald Reagan in 1981, enjoyed the status of being the justice with the swing vote. In a sharply divided court, 4-4, she was able to register the crucial fifth vote. And while she, to the end of her working days, she would deny that she was the swing vote, the reality is she knew it, and she had to enjoy that leverage that she had, deciding in one case to vote with the relative conservatives, in another the relative progressives, which gave her a great opportunity to shape the law for many, many years. Justice Kennedy succeeded Justice O'Connor in that role. After she retired from the court, then he became that person riding that horse. Unlike Justice O'Connor, who denied that she was the swing vote, who denied that she had any joy in that, Justice Kennedy was very open among friends, saying he enjoyed that role and he was enjoying the opportunity to shape the law. So here was Kennedy now building his legacy through Romer versus Evans, through Lawrence versus Texas. And then, of course, we come to the very fundamental decisions affecting tens of millions of Americans in our country in 2013, when the court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act, in which the Congress had, during the Clinton era, passed a law providing that the federal government, in fact, could not recognize state laws that recognize same-sex marriage. There, Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion, striking it down, again saying that there is this 14th Amendment right that exists at the state level for individuals to make these intimate decisions, and effectively denying federal power to govern state laws regulating marriage, saying that marriage, of course, is a state power. Well, the great case that excited tens of millions of Americans would occur 2 years later in Obergefell versus Hodges, and that would be, of course, the same-sex marriage case, which became very controversial. And Justice Kennedy writes that opinion. This is not breaking news. This is the one place where you're not getting breaking news every second you watch a show or listen to the news. This is not breaking news. Justice Kennedy writes the opinion that holds that homosexuals have a right to engage in marriage just as heterosexuals do, that it is a 14th Amendment right, a byproduct of due process of law and equal protection of the laws. And again, he leans heavily on this assertion of the right to make intimate choices, going all the way back to Griswold through Roe versus Wade and so forth. The irony of the decision in the same-sex marriage case, which for many Americans rang like a fire bell in the night — that's Thomas Jefferson's old colorful phrase, one of those fire bells which would wake you up at 3 a.m., you'd be full of adrenaline, you'd be scared, you'd be filled with anxiety. For many Americans, it was a very happy day. For many others, it was a very unhappy day. And of course, it remains controversial. But that outcome that same-sex marriage would be upheld had been predicted by a very disappointed Justice Antonin Scalia, who wrote a bitterly worded dissent in Lawrence versus Texas, pointing out that the Supreme Court's decisions are clearly taking the nation to the point where the case will come before the Supreme Court asking whether or not there is a fundamental right to same-sex marriage. So Justice Scalia was indeed prescient on that point. The question before the court in Obergefell was a simple one: whether or not there was a constitutional right as a matter of a fundamental right for same-sex couples to marry. Kennedy was able to dispatch that decision pretty quickly by simply hanging his hat on his own opinions and the several precedents that he had previously established. You're in a very happy spot if you can cite your own work as authority, and that's like an ipsy dixit. Why is this the law? Because I said so. Not just him, but speaking for the court. The fact is that in addition to tracing the evolution of this right to choose and to choose to make intimate decisions in your life, that it's a matter of equal protection. And he rehearsed how the country had moved through equal protection with respect to both women's rights and the rights of African Americans, bringing our story full circle back to the point where I said at the outset that the discrimination against gays and lesbians followed the same pattern of discrimination against African Americans and also against women. And he could turn his attention to Loving versus Virginia, 1967 Supreme Court decision coming out of Virginia, a very fine movie made out of that case, if you recall. That was the decision in which the Supreme Court struck down the anti-miscegenation statutes that had prohibited interracial marriage. And it's a wonderful story. And what he said in Obergefell versus Hodges was that the country had the same trepidation about blacks marrying whites as it now has with respect to same-sex marriage. And as scholars pointed out, we reached the point in time where when we look at ordinances or rules or laws denying gays and lesbians equal rights, we could essentially simply substitute the word black or African American. Anytime we want to look at an ordinance or a state law or any other regulation that seems to treat gays and lesbians in a way that's different than all other Americans, just plug in that word black American or African American and ask yourselves, does that seem right? Does that seem to fit our Constitution? Thus, our discussion has come full circle. We're reminded then of how movements have fought successfully to overcome rampant discrimination, widespread discrimination. And this sets up our discussion for 2 weeks from now on August 8th, when we can enter into some of the great controversies involving rights of gays and lesbians, including the hot button issue of the assertion of individual religious rights by owners of businesses to refuse to deny their services to, let's say, a same-sex couple, and then moving on to public accommodations. That's what comes next, but I don't want to preempt that too much. How about questions or concerns about tonight's topic? I just covered about 2,000 years of history in 40 minutes because I knew you were up to the task. Any comments or questions about tonight's discussion? Very good question. Actually not, but the reality is that he was very, very sympathetic to members of the LGBT community, largely out of the, as a matter of principle, right to privacy and equal protection. And I might add that, of course, as he decided to retire from the court just two and a half years ago, that he was being urged to retire with the assurance that his former law clerk, Justice Gorsuch, would likely follow in his footsteps, and that, it has been written, said it gave him enough confidence that his legacy might be maintained. Of course, the jury, so to speak, is still out on that because we've yet to see enough decisions written by Justice Gorsuch, and we've not seen, of course, major cases involving this area of the law. So it remains to be seen whether Justice Kennedy made a decision that he'll be happy with. Oh, please, Jamin. I could do that. So going back 45 minutes ago, the question was asked, was Justice Kennedy gay? And I said no, and then went on to explain that he was simply very sympathetic to gays and lesbians as a matter of constitutional rights to privacy and equal protection. Yeah, great. I'll do that. Thank you for the reminder. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yes, do I have any cases in mind in which the court failed to uphold the rights of gays and lesbians, right? There would be, I can't give you names right now, but there were dozens and dozens of cases brought in the 1930s and 40s and 50s in which gay plaintiffs were hoping to vindicate their rights. But of course, the They never won cases. And I would add, and I'm very glad you asked that, because I would add that the same was true for women's rights in those days, and only marginally better for the rights of African Americans. So if we are to develop a general theme here, we would say that the elements of sexism and racism and discrimination against the LGBT community was very, very consistent. If we take just a minute or so to rehearse the history of the practice of discrimination against Black Americans to show you the similarity of the paths, we would say that, of course, the Supreme Court in 1896 in Plessy versus Ferguson set forth the separate but equal doctrine, which would uphold state-ordered segregation, treating Blacks as second-class citizens. From 1896 to 1954, the year of the landmark decision in Brown versus the Board of Education, the Supreme Court, handed out small victories to the NAACP that challenged separate but equal, saying in effect that for example, the separate school facilities for Blacks and whites are not equal, and sought to require federal courts to uphold the separate but equal doctrine literally, meaning if states are going to segregate the races when it comes to education, then at least, by George, make sure that the schools reserved for Blacks are equal to the schools reserved for whites. And the NAACP won numerous cases, but those proved to be hollow victories because it would have taken 100 years or more to actually reach any substantial improvement. Similarly, for women, all the efforts brought by women to vindicate their rights to due process of law or equal treatment under the law were unsuccessful following that same path. So, for example, in 1948, the Supreme Court would deny that women could even work in a tavern because, of course, there's nothing but mischief or trouble ahead for a woman who worked in a bar. In 1961, the Supreme Court would reiterate that women were not allowed to serve, that women had no constitutional right under the 14th Amendment to serve on juries because, as the Supreme Court explained, women had a central role to play in the household, and that it serving on a jury would take them away from those fundamental duties and responsibilities. They should stay in the home and raise a family. And, oh, by the way, there was a strong element of paternalism involving women, which is to say, we don't want women to become involved in the hideous business of making decisions on juries because of their frail nature, and it would be too stressful. And I could go on and on. So, and in terms of cases in which suits were brought by gays and lesbians trying to vindicate their rights, they would get nowhere because the courts, the federal courts across the country, were simply saying that there is no right to engage in homosexual behavior, that it's aberrant, that it's a crime against nature. And so in many ways, the treatment of members of the LGBT community was more brutal in the 40s and 50s from a legal standpoint than it was even for African Americans and women because gay men and lesbians could never even get off the ground. They had no rights because they were always guilty of engaging in a crime. And I say it was more brutal as a consequence because they were forced to go underground. That's why I said earlier in the talk that the few gay bars in the South Village in Greenwich were bars in which they were relatively safe because the police were paid off, but there was only this one bar where even members of the LGBT community could safely dance, and that was under different circumstances. So the similarity here is really a denial of legal status to Blacks, to women, and to gays and lesbians. It would not change, and this is a wonderful historical story, it would not change until members of the LGBT community assumed responsibility and began to lead their own movement as an outgrowth of the Stonewall riots, in the same way that life for African Americans did not change until the NAACP organized and began to bring cases in the 1930s. In the same way that women were not granted any rights by men, they had to earn their way inch by inch. So the story here, and I think this is reflective of a pretty common thread, is that if you want to win rights, you have to fight for rights. You're not going to be given them, and that's certainly the story for these three groups. Yeah, please, Stephanie. Well, that's a very interesting question. The question asked about the fact that occasionally the Supreme Court changes its mind, which is demonstrated historically, and the concern that maybe the court might change its mind because there's a lot of discussion on an elemental issue such as abortion, going back to Roe versus Wade, and then asking whether or not there's any concern that the hard-won rights within the LGBT community might in fact be undone or undermined. It's a great question to ask because there are possibilities. There are possibilities as the composition of the Supreme Court changes, which reminds us that in American constitutional law, nothing is set in stone. Much as we would like that kind of predictability, some areas of the law are more settled than others, but in some controversial areas, what we really live with are some definite maybes. Nothing written in stone, but we have some definite maybes, we might say. And as the court's composition changes, there's always the possibility that cases can come back to the court, raising anew the kinds of issues that we had thought were settled. Thus, as you ask about abortion rights, clearly participants in the conservative world dearly want the court to overturn Roe versus Wade. Politicians reflective of that thought have urged that judges and justices should be appointed that would overturn Roe versus Wade. Certainly, President Trump has made no secret about his interest in placing on the court justices that would overturn Roe versus Wade. Similarly, when it comes to the newly minted rights for members of the LGBT community, you have to believe that they're always at risk. Given the close vote on the Supreme Court in the same-sex marriage case, why should we believe that that case law is so well settled that the court would never entertain another challenge to it? The reality is that it's not old law. It was 2015, 4 years old. And even though the court tends to pay greater respect to older decisions, the older a decision is, the greater standing it has, thus making Marbury versus Madison of 1803 the great graybeard of constitutional precedents. Arlen Specter, a conservative senator from Pennsylvania and a defender of Roe versus Wade, always liked to refer to Roe versus Wade as, quote, a super duper precedent. That's a technical term. Super duper precedent, unassailable, couldn't be overturned, but of course we see it is threatened. And federal courts, with the permission of the Supreme Court, has chipped away at Roe versus Wade. Still not tinkering with that first trimester and the assertion of a fundamental right, but everything that comes afterward. That's still up for grabs. And so here we see, so you asked the right question about the future of these newly minted rights in the LGBT community. Yeah. Well, you raise a good question about the social progress or the social movement. Because sometimes the court does pay attention to what we would call the cultural status or the social status of a of a law and interpretation of a constitutional provision. There's a great Harvard Law scholar for many years named Paul Freund who coined a phrase that many of us like to invoke, and that is that the court doesn't pay close attention to the weather of the day, but to the climate of the era, which is a very nice phrase. And what he was saying was reiterating what other judges had written in various books and essays, and that is that judges do pay attention to what people are talking about. Benjamin Cardozo, Justice Cardozo of the Supreme Court, a very, very bright man, but we had him on the court for only about 8 years because of bad health, wrote that in two great books, wrote that judges are citizens. In his day, back in the 20s, he said, we go down to the post office and we talk to our neighbors and we go to the coffee shop and we do this. We're always mingling. It's bound to affect us. And so one of the enduring questions about the Supreme Court is, to what extent, if any, is the court affected by cultural views, social values? On the one hand, we like to say that the Supreme Court is a law court. It should not be influenced because then it becomes simply another organ of government resembling a legislature. On the other hand, we know from the statements of some justices that they do pay attention to what the public says. None other than the late Chief Justice William Rehnquist wrote in his book on the Supreme Court that the court would frequently take note of public protests, of the public disposition on an issue. That leaves the open-ended question, if so, to what extent might the court be affected? And that could change from justice to justice. So on this question, then, about the status of the newly minted rights, it's not clear to me that they're hardened in concrete, that they are vulnerable, is the word I would use. And given the recent challenges grounded in assertions of free exercise claims, that is, religious claims by owners, to deny their products to same-sex couples raises the question then of the very future of the right of members of the LGBT community to equal treatment under the law. That's, to me, that's a big question. Yeah, Karen asked a great question about the impact of the DSM, and we would also say the American Psychiatric Association in 1952 claiming that homosexuality was a personality disorder. So, and Karen wonders, what when you have these, when you have these official statements from organizations and professional associations, does that have an effect on the court? You bet it does, because courts would often, in refusing to uphold rights for gays and lesbians, could always fall back on that assertion. Homosexuals suffer from a personality disorder, and so forth. So it was a deeply prejudicial view, but again, not unlike the deeply prejudicial views exhibited toward blacks and women. It's all the way back to 1896 in Plessy versus Ferguson, where the court could say, if blacks have a problem with segregation, it's their problem. They're too thin. This is what Justice Brown wrote. It's their problem. They're too thin-skinned. They need to realize that whites don't want to mingle with blacks. The coldest two or three sentences I think I've ever read in the annals of the Supreme Court doctrines. And again, the similar denunciation, the similar acts demeaning women as inferior, that they belong in the home, etc. So the demeaning treatment of blacks and women and gays and lesbians runs like a real clear thread throughout our history. Hard to believe, isn't it? So we could say that we've come a long way, relatively speaking, but there's always a question about the security of these newly won rights. Please. Great question. Where are the differences now between same-sex marriage and civil unions and common law marriages? Well, given the Supreme Court's ruling in the Obergefell case, the same-sex marriage, the answers are pretty much out there for us now. We needn't worry any longer about trying to distinguish between same-sex marriage and civil unions. The assertion of a civil union was really a political means of trying to delay the implementation or the statement at law about same-sex marriage. But with the court's decision, there's no real point to that. Common law marriage will persist. The assertion of a common law marriage will persist, but that would cross lines when it comes to gender orientation, not necessarily endemic to heterosexual or homosexual relations. Think about this. I'm still thinking about Stephanie's question. Your question reminds me of this. What if the court were to change its mind in the next year or two and decide that the same-sex marriage decision was wrongly decided. Now, on the one hand, and to overturn it, on the one hand, we would see incredible chaos unleashed across the country, and that might lead us to believe that the court would not do such a thing because the court doesn't want to introduce chaos into our country. On the other hand, there are at least three members of the court on record as saying if the court determines that an earlier decision was wrongly decided, we have no obligation to persist in the error by the court. And that might seem a little hard or harsh, but maybe that would lead the court to overturn same-sex marriage. Depends on the complement of justices. So if you look at the complement of the court right now, we have five conservatives, as they're often described. And I would just say to you in the classroom, I never like to use the term conservative and liberal because I think those are not appropriate terms to describe the jurisprudence of the court. But here we are in the public realm, and I'm looking for shorthand terms to use. So roughly speaking, we have five more or less conservatives and four more or less progressives, right? What if in the 2020 election a Democrat should win the presidency and one of those conservative members should retire or for some reason or another leave the court? That could give a Democratic president then the opportunity to redress the imbalance that was created when Senate Majority Leader McConnell refused to hold a hearing for President Obama's nominee Merrick Garland, correct? And all could be restored. But wait a minute, what if the Senate is still in the hands of the Republican Party? Why would Mitch McConnell hold a hearing on a Democratic nomination to fill a vacancy that is absolutely crucial to his party's control of the Supreme Court? Having been successful once, why would he say, I'm not going to do it again? That's what actually concerns me, that I think that could well be the wave of our future. It troubles me greatly, because if the Senate is not going to hold hearings on nominees of the other party and hold the court hostage, that's a real concern. But at any rate, on that fundamental question about overturning a bad precedent, there is merit to the question, why should the court persist in judicial error? It's hard to find a good argument. The argument usually is, well, we don't want to introduce chaos and essentially upset the apple cart. So we'll see. Well, I think we've exhausted our time. Any other last questions or comments? Oh, please.
Where are we with the military?
Where are we with the military? And you mean treatment of LGBT? Well, right now, the right of the members of the LGBT community to serve are secure. And, of course, that remains controversial. We don't know. Congress could change that at any point. Congress could change the law.
But isn't that a right?
The court has not said it's a fundamental right to serve in the military, deferring to Congress, following the law enacted by Congress. So if Congress should, for some reason, decide that, in fact, it doesn't want gays or lesbians serving, it could change that.
Historically, what we want to recognize is that when it comes to our national defense, raising armies and navies, that that power is wholly vested in Congress. While I think it's too late in the day to say women can no longer serve in the military, and I would like to think it's too late in the day now to say that gays and lesbians can't serve, that's not written in stone. It's one of those definite maybes. And that might be a function of politics at the congressional level. I would go out on a limb and say it's not likely that those areas will be overturned. We would have to have a massive shift in American politics, I think, for that to happen. Anything? Thank you all. Thanks very much for coming. And again, thank you to our sponsors, the Shides and to Breaking Boundaries. And I hope you'll return on August 8th when we turn to a few more controversial areas. And I want to thank Jamin Anderson of KISU for coming up and recording. And this will be rebroadcast on August 5th. Okay. Thank you. Good night. Thank you.